Just a bit of recapitulation. If this is true that you only have in the central part of the story a narrative, and that what you have in the first introduction is, well, God talk. God talks, makes his decisions to destroy and also to preserve at least a remnant. And then at the end also tells you what it means. Then you can almost see that it's like that Trojan nuclear place that I saw, a plant that I wouldn't have understood if I'd just taken a tour through the place, if I hadn't had the orientation before, and also the orientation afterwards. So in other words, this is, and it seems they realized this, that you wouldn't understand what in the world is going on in this catastrophe story unless you had that introduction. And then the conclusion. Now we've come, I think, as far as our discussion to part C. So why don't we take that? It's on page 3 of this edited section. And
good speech technique. They tell him what he's going to tell him, and he tells him, and he tells him what he told him.
Yeah, well, you know, that is the impression a person has of the priestly writing in general. The priestly writing is, some people call it monotonous. I think it takes a little more sympathy. But I wouldn't underestimate him. I was just reading this morning, he is the only guy that talks about the fish. All the rest in this whole flood business don't do that. But somehow the priestly writer, we'll see here, talks about when they get out that they should have dominion and domestication of everything, including the fish, which shows that this is met universally. It doesn't make much sense, really, I suppose, as far as historically, the freshwater fish and saltwater fish and all that business, how much water there is. But it does show, I guess I've been intrigued recently, largely through my study of Ezekiel. Because if you want to have a real priestly writer, a person that has the priestly perspective, then you have an Ezekiel. And it's a very, very deep theology. He doesn't say much, and he seems to be repetitious and boring and everything else. His style not nearly as lively as the Yahwist, but he's really got something. Now, the first part that we read here, and why don't we make you read it, Bob, since you like the Yahwist, is this... verses 20 through 22, rather famous section.
Then Noah built an altar to the Lord, and took of every clean animal and every clean bird, and offered burnt offerings on the altar. When the Lord smelled the pleasing odor, the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground because of man, for the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I ever again destroy every living creature as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease.
Yeah, I printed it that way so you see the parallelism of the poetry, which it is. All right, any observations or comments that you...
Doesn't that, the parallelism, doesn't it read down?
No, it reads across, just the way you read it. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night.
Did we ever define the unclean animal that the pig was mentioned? Did we have any better, or are there more?
Well, someone said that one of having a... It's a rule of thumb that's mentioned in Leviticus, but it's merely that rule of thumb with a cloven hoof and choose a cud, see? But that is not really what's behind it. What's really behind it is anything that is connected with Baal worship. See, people did not eat meat ordinarily. What did you eat in Palestine? We're meat eaters here.
Grain and fruit.
Yeah, grain and fruit, and that's it. And whenever you did eat meat, it was usually in a part of a sacrifice, the shelamim, the communion sacrifice. And therefore, it was usually religious to see that. So to eat the pork would be, since that was the animal for Baal, was to be unclean. And there are many other creepy crawly things, you see, that the Canaanites had. And to eat them that made it unclean. It's a religious reason, not a dietary reason. And same thing what we mentioned with death. So does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Now here, you notice that he takes of the clean animals and a very clean bird and offers a burnt offering. What does that mean, a burnt offering?
That's the total.
Yeah, he doesn't keep a thing. And now this may seem odd, you know, you need all the protein you can get. And they're, what do we call that, the protein deficiency. But and they knew that as well as we do, and they needed to, and they did have they ate meat. They were meat eaters. That is a clean thing. But now here he takes of the clean things and gives that to the Lord, burns it up, and doesn't take a part of it. That I guess that's the meaning of a burnt offering. You see that? You don't even get the barbecue. From many sacrifices, Shelomim, a communion, you get part of it, or a food offering, or something like that. And then there was eating and drinking, and the poor got part of it. And you would, when you brought a sacrifice, you would declare what the Lord had done to you. It was kind of part of your thanksgiving. And then everybody else, it was kind of a built-in social security system. The poor were there to receive it. It was a marvelous sort of thing. Now, I suppose what is here is much more universal. This is the universal experience of everyone. When you've escaped some great catastrophe, what do? You thank those who helped you, isn't it? So what does he do? He builds an altar and he sacrifices. That's very common. And you remember that, don't you? By the way, this, I think, is important, what shall we say, liturgically. Too much liturgy, especially in the mainline churches, high churches, Lutheranism tends that way, is purely on schedule. 11 o'clock, 8 o'clock. And when you ring the bell, then you're supposed to worship. But unless you have spontaneous worship like this, which comes out of crisis situation, the others grows flat, the formal sort of thing. I think we kind of know that. There has to be that balance between the two. A lot of people make fun of crisis religion. The only time people pray is when they're in troubles. But that's universally human to pray. Prayer is not, sure, Christian prayer is prayer in the name of Jesus and in the Spirit. But everybody prays, and everybody gives thanks, too, in one way or another. And that's a kind of a universal sort of thing. So I think that's what's going on here. Any other comments or questions?
It's presumed, I guess, that the animals have been fruitful and multiplied on board the ark.
Well, he had seven to begin with, you see, so he had a little extra. He had seven of the clean animals anyway. So he could.
Well, my question really is, how great a sacrifice is it? I mean, is he really sort of threatening the possibility of restocking the world, or?
I don't think he's going that far, but your observation is good. I think he's taking of what is the prize possessions that he has and giving that. I don't think that he's going that far, since there's enough left over. When it says that the Lord smells the sweet savor, what do you think that means? How would you put that in our terminology? Lord has a hand like I do.
Would that be the Lord really appreciated the sacrifice?
He what?
The Lord appreciated the sacrifice.
Yeah.
Your answer's prayer.
He answered, yeah. How would you know if you were an Israelite and you brought a sacrifice, and how did you know whether your sacrifice was accepted or not? We mentioned that a little with Cain and Abel's story. How did you know that?
Well, the old Bible picture used to say that Abel smoked my nose.
Well, there is a mention of that in Ezekiel, of the this going up, and then the Lord smells it. By the way, you have to have. I have only in one place been up in Nepal, and outside of Kathmandu, to the goddess Kali, witnessed this business of an animal sacrifice, and it smells a half a block away. All of the warmth and all of the intestine stuff and all that stuff, you know. You've got to have a lot of perfume and scent and sweet-smelling stuff there to somehow hold that down, and they did. They had powerful ones. One of my profs at the University of Chicago said he was there when they opened the mummy, and that the perfume was still tremendously great. It was still working. And so I suppose this idea of a sweet smell, it's an old expression, of course. But the idea is, as you said, it's acceptable.
Oh, cremation, the smell of, I haven't seen sacrifices, but I've passed cremation pyres.
Yeah.
And that's, if you like it, it's sweet smelling. It isn't very pleasant smelling, but it, the smell of cremated flesh is kind of sickly sweet.
Is that because of the flesh, or is that because of the wood?
The sandalwood. That, you see, that's one of the, if you're really up in society, you are cremated, not that it matters much anymore, but you're cremated in sandalwood.
Mm-hmm.
And sandalwood is very fragrant.
Yeah. Okay, well, one more thing here. The Lord says, as he smells this,
is the draft of the chat? Isn't it over by you, Tim? Is that?
It's open.
Is it open?
There's
a window open.
I'll pull it if anyone wants to. Does it come down there?
It seems to be going straight up. We started talking about smoke going sideways. It seems to be going straight again.
It's drawing.
Yeah. Sorry.
No, it's all right. No, the words that he says when he accepts this are the important ones. I'll never again curse the ground because of man. And now notice the reason. For the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. We just had that before.
Mm-hmm. That's why he was going to have the flood.
Yes, and now does a flood change things? Does a catastrophe change it? Well, that's interesting. But now, how's he going to deal with it? By bearing it. Forbearance, if you want to use that word, or by carrying it himself. This is a very interesting sort of thing. He'll not do it. In other words, shall we say man is incorrigible? Something like that. This is not the way to deal with it. Neither will I ever again destroy every living creature as I have done. And now comes that, I think it's the climax with that poetry. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will not cease. In other words, he guarantees what?
Guarantees of mankind. Go ahead. Crops.
All right. Well, there is heaven in the beginning, and there will be an end. The earth is not eternal. But in between, what is going to happen?
An order to the universe.
Creation will continue. That's why I said last time when we started this, that in the sense the deluge story is a complement, a necessary complement, supplement to the creation story. To show you that creation is God's activity in the face of chaos and everything else that could happen, catastrophe.
The flood actually then being chaos itself.
Yes, I think when it said that the windows of heaven were open, you know, and the fountains of the deep, then it was all going back to chaos, practically.
Mm-hmm. The only trouble with that is, I think, it sounds... So what God really did when he created was not create, but order the chaos mm-hmm. into the world. And now God's disappointed or angry with the way the order worked out, particularly with man, so he allows the chaos to rise up again. And mm-hmm. somehow for
well, it depends a little, I think, Harold, what we mean by the word chaos. You see that?
Yeah, I'm sure it does.
The earliest Symmachus, I think it was, it's not the Septuagint, but the earliest very, very literalistic translation of Tohu Vabohu in Genesis 1-2 was in Greek aparaskoitas, unprepared, not so much chaos. In fact, even the Septuagint doesn't use that word, Greek word chaos, but that had so many mythical connections, you see, it was practically a deity. So I think they would shy away from drawing that particular conclusion. But I think you're tending in the right direction that... what shall we say? If there is going to be a time when man can live here between the beginning and the end. And this is God's activity with all creatures, on top of which then will be the history of salvation. See, that's superimposed on top of it. Then you can be sure that God will preserve day and night, cold and heat, and as long as the earth remains. Now, when the end comes and there is no more earth, and God puts a final end, that again we can't speak any more than we can speak about the beginning. We have no empirical understanding of that, and they didn't either. The apocalypticists will see that, and whenever things fall apart, in late Judaism you have this rising from what had been prophecy to apocalypticism, where they would see the end, not just of the nation of Israel, but they would see the end of the whole world. And then catastrophe, like in Joel, the catastrophe of even the locusts taking away their crop, and that really meant starvation for a lot of them. That was a sign and a symbol of the end. And I suppose that's when this story begins to speak to us, because even though we maybe haven't at least had the ultimate Big Bang that knocked us all out, for the people who get caught in some bombing of Dresden or whatever it is, that, even though it's penultimate, it's really the end for them. And that's when these stories simply live. Just like the Book of Revelation lives. One pastor told me in Germany, I asked him about the bombings. He said, well, he could see Nuremberg burning one night, and he could see Würzburg burning the next night. And then he said, then we lived in the Book of Revelation. And then it meant something. And I heard George Knight in England, the opposite side of the war front, saying the same thing. And I think that's when you get an idea. And still you have this idea that there's, and you have a rainbow to guarantee it now, in the last part, that this is the sign of the covenant. Now the covenant had been mentioned beforehand, before they went into the ark. Remember that? I'll make my covenant. And there was kind of a guarantee. And the whole time schedule, you knew when you started that there would be an end. And this is kind of the same sort of thing. Despite the delinquency, despite the fact that here, from his youth, the imagination of man's heart is evil. So, in other words, God is going to take the ride with man and preserve this with all mankind.
The poetic statement in verse 22 sounds to me as though the earth will remain so long as there's not a serious ecological imbalance. At the point that we have depletion of resources and sufficiently...
No, I think you're bringing it up. Mm-hmm.
That really will bespeak the end of the earth.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It does not say that, you know, it says while the earth remains, you see that,
Yeah. Then
he will guarantee it. But
it doesn't say it's going to go with a bang either.
I don't think that even when Jesus used the apocalyptic ideas, if he felt that all these things, most of the symbols that he was using there, you know, the sun... losing its light and so forth, were already ciphers, apocalyptic ciphers. It wasn't just as if he thought that this is the way it's going to happen on a time schedule. I think maybe for us, in as far as I know, this would be where to clue in on this business of filling the world with violence. To me, I object to the fact that they make a horse trail through through the wilderness here, you know. I guess maybe I'm just too much of a wilderness person, I don't know. but
does this say anything about the understanding of what it means to have dominion over the earth?
Yes, I think it does.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I mean, in the earliest Greek stories, the idea was that nature was inexhaustible. And there was just man's right to take whatever he wanted and take whatever he wanted. And there was no sense of any sort of ethical restraint. You know? Nature was inexhaustible, always going to be replenished, and you know, you could just take it, it's there to be raped, so to speak. But here there seems to be quite a different notion,
Yes. A
notion of really caring. The dominion is not, you know, that it's ours to boss around and take what we want, but really to care for, because of an inherent fragileness of it.
Precisely. The word yarad in Hebrew is a royal word, and in Genesis 1:28, have dominion. Not only be fruitful and multiply, but have dominion. It's used, and I'm quite sure the Yavis and other people in Israel that understood that, or the priestly people too, would use that word as an Israelite king. An Israelite king was not an absolute monarch to do anything he wanted. And he was not a divine being like the Pharaoh, a god on earth. But he had to judge with righteousness. And that's a covenant word. So he was in the covenant. You remember, first, kingship shouldn't have been in Israel. And when they established it, the so-called Samuel Compromise, then Samuel tried to keep it within the covenant. He had a lot of trouble with the delinquent kings. But the Messianic king, the final end-time king that the prophets talked about, would be one who would reign in righteousness and do it just that way. So, in a sense, man is on earth to be God's viceroy, a representative, and to have dominion to care for the earth. Yeah, I think that's included here. It's not inexhaustible. This will become clear in the next section. Yes? Mm-hmm.
Is there any relationship between this chaos of the flood and the Noah story with baptism?
This is, as a natural analogy, you can always have analogies, and First Peter does it, you see. And Luther's baptismal prayer in the formula of baptism also does it, see. Here it's interesting that the waters of the flood by themselves do not wash away sin. What you need is God's word and God's promise and his rainbow, and that is almost a sacrament. In fact, the word sacramentum in Latin is the same, it's a sign of a covenant. You take a stick and you break it. You give one to one man and one to the other in old Latin, and then that's a sign of their covenant, because only that part of the stick fits together. And that's the sign of their covenant, see? And so you have many covenants. Now, this is only the first one. It's universal. And by the way, it's not just with Noah and his family. It's with the birds and the beasts, as we'll see. They're the old priest. He doesn't miss a thing. It's with everything. It's universal. And he will not destroy the world as he has done. Then, does anybody know the next big major covenant between God and the people? Well, that's the one with Abram. In thee and in thy seed, all the nations will be blessed. You see that? Now then you're in a history of salvation, you see. Does anybody know what the sign, the sacramentum of that testamentum was, of that covenant?
Circumcision,
yes. That very member of the body by which the seed is to be begotten is circumcised. The idea being what? That those that are born here within the promise, not just of the will of the flesh. That, I think that's the idea. And then the idea of a cleanliness, you see. But it's basically a real rite. It's a, well, it has a history behind it too, a prehistory. But in Israel, it's a sign of that promise. The next big one, and this is what we call the Old Covenant, the Sinaitic Covenant. That has a sign too. Does anybody know that? I give $64 here. If anybody knows, what's the sign of the Sinaitic Covenant? The Old Covenant made at Mount Sinai. The Big Covenant. Kind of risky business here. Not the ark. That was more or less the throne on which he sat invisibly in the Holy of Holies as a throne.
Now, where did they make the tablets?
The ark, that was inside of the ark, it's a sign. It's the Ark of the Covenant, and the tablets are inside there. The documentation of that. But in Exodus 31, very clear, it's the Sabbath is the sign. Think if we were Jews, Heschel would tell us, and other people would tell us, that's what it is, really the Shabbat, the Sabbath. By the way, this last word here, will not cease, is, I noticed that this morning when I read it in Hebrew, it was Shabbat, will not have its Sabbath. It will not cease. Well, it's not used in that case, but it's interesting, you can play with words. By the way, for the New Testament people, for the New Covenant, Jesus, the night of his betrayal, has, this is the New Covenant in my blood. Okay? Already the prophets had spoken about that, Jeremiah, that there will be a New Covenant take place, the Old Covenant. What's the sacramentum? What's the sign, the symbol of that covenant? Well, the body and blood of Jesus. Well, sacramentally and also historically. And so that it gets to be a big theme, a very big theme. And I'd say that is the distinctive element, the Israelite element in this. Otherwise, this is very much parallel to the stories that we find inside of the Epic of Gilgamesh, the story of Utnapishtim, the Babylonian Noah. Let's talk about that for just a minute before we go on. Does anybody know how that differs from this one? There's a second one that has been found more recently, Athrasis. We always had fragments, but now recently we have the whole thing. It has a creation story, it has a story of genealogies and growth and so forth, it has a flood story, and so they had their own very similar things to Genesis 1 to 11.
I haven't read it yet.
I see. Well, let's talk a little about, well, if, first of all, it's polytheistic. If I remember correctly, it happens in Shapuruk, and the gods, the old gods, anyway, they're not being able to sleep because the people in Shapuruk are making so much noise, and here they're in their temples at night, and the rest of them are carousing and so forth, and finally they get angry, and they have a council of the gods, and they say, we're going to destroy these people because they're wicked. But there's one squealer god, and his name is Ea, and he can't, because he's made the oath, he can't really directly squeal and say to the Babylonian Noah, Utnapishtim, that he should make an ark. But he can go to the reed hut in which Utnapishtim is, and he knows he'll hear it, and speak to the reed hut in double entendre, double words, and Noah, he says, don't you know there's going to be a great rain of grain? You could translate it like that. And it's really with double words, there's going to be a great flood. Why don't you get ready and have this, it's one of those Mesopotamian big rafts, you see. Only it's, again, kind of a never-never sort of thing. It's a cube with seven stories and I suppose 49 nests in it. And that's the one he's going to make. And does anyone know how long it lasts, the Babylonian? Oh, 7 days, 7 nights. And it comes down in the Zagros Mountains, the highest mountains that they had right close by there. It isn't Mount Ararat, or is Indian comparable things with the Himalayas or something like that. And there, for instance, when they load the ark, it's described in great detail how he puts all kinds of gold and silver and all kinds of things on it, and precious things, and then when the ark comes down and they survive the catastrophe. In that story, especially the main god, his name is Enlil, he's a storm god, he is angry that someone survived. And he's ready to kill Utnapishtim and all that have survived. And finally, Utnapishtim has the sense to sacrifice. And when he cuts the throats of the sacrificial animals and that warm blood oozes out, then the gods like that. And they come like pigs at a trough, and they slurp it up, and then finally even Enlil, whose liver has been really angry, is very polytheistic. It's very closer than you think, you know. Even though we smile at that, the polytheism, he slurps it down, and his anger is no longer there. But then they say that Utnapishtim is supposed to live way off there, and he can't live. He becomes immortal because he survived the flood. He lives way off there beyond the kind of a stinking, like a Styx river. And that's where finally this famous hero Gilgamesh went to get him. Gilgamesh was looking for eternal life and couldn't find it anywhere else, but one barmaid said, well, there's one guy got eternal life, and he lives way off there. And there Utnapishtim finally, I guess he makes a kind of a raft. And he has 52 poles, by the way. Notice the whole weeks for a year? And he punts. Each time he punts, he has to throw the thing away because it contaminated him. He'll punt again. He doesn't quite make it until he puts his shirt up. And he finally floats there. And Utnapishtim and his wife, they're quite surprised to see him. And then he said, I want eternal life. Well, he said, I've got it, but and this is how I got it. And that's how he tells the whole flood story, because I survived the flood. But you can't have it. Mm-hmm. Then at the end, Gilgamesh, after he's told the whole flood story, according to the Babylonian version, Utnapishtim falls like a baby and says, oh, I've got to have that too. Well, he says, let's see whether you can conquer sleep. Sleep is a twin brother of death. And he's been so tired from all his exhaustion and punting and so forth that immediately falls asleep. But Utnapishtim has his wife bake bread every day in the kiln, and for 7 days. It always happens that way. And when finally Utnapishtim, who slept for 7 days and seven nights, wakes up, Gilgamesh, then he said, well, you can't even conquer sleep. How can you conquer death? And then he says, I didn't sleep. I just closed my eyes. And he says, no, look at this bread is a moldy already. And this is hard and all this and that. And then shows him that it's going on. Well, then, finally, do you know what he says? He says, if you dive down into the Persian Gulf, there's a certain herb down there that will give you eternal life. And so, sure enough, he goes down to the Persian Gulf, and he dives down like those pearl divers with stones attached to him like an old scuba diver to hold him down. And he gets it. And he comes up and he goes back to Shapuruk, and he just about gets back there when he's dusty and dirty. So he sees a pond there and he takes off his clothes and wraps that special immortality-giving herb in his clothes and puts it on the side. And then he dives in and washes himself. But meanwhile, a serpent comes and eats it and immediately sloughs its skin. And a serpent, you see, does that. It never dies. It simply sloughs its skin. That's the way it is. And that's why a serpent sloughs its skin, and that's why it goes on and it tells everything. And there are even epilogues to it. Now, that's one version. It's a very interesting sort of version. But you can see the Israelite version. By the way, when this was first found in the library of Ashurbanipal, and they brought it to the London Times and people read it, it became a phenomenon. And everybody said, see, that's older than the Bible. The Bible comes from Babylon. Maybe you've heard of the German version of that fight. They called it the Bibel Babel Streit. The Bibel kommt von Babel. The Bible comes from Babylon. Sure, even the Kaiser got mixed up in it, and he had to almost can some people at the University of Berlin. They had the same sort of John Birching we have. And I happen to have the translated documents of that. It's a fascinating sort of stuff. But that was bad enough that then you realize that what we had here has to be dealt with in a different way. Then they found the Enuma Elish. I talked to you about that last when we had the Genesis 1. And now with the Ahasuerus, the parallels here are very thin. So I don't think it's enough to do what the earlier scholars did. What did they do? Well, the very early one said this is a report of historical events just that way. And you better believe it. Then the next ones came along and they more or less said, well, this is a combination of the Yahwist and the priestly. We know what the Yahwist theology is and from the rest of the Bible, so we know what the theology of this is as a history of salvation thing. Even Von Rad still has that. Or we know what the priestly writing, what their theology is. They never took this seriously as primeval stories, primordial stories. See, that story of the creation and also the Atharathis story of the flood was read in Babylon at their New Year's festival. And didn't we see in this second New Year's even in Israel? And I think it had its place even in Israel as part of the idea of how is creation going to go on in the new year? And it's just what this says here. It's an affirmation of the regularity of creation and God's guarantee with a rainbow of it. But we should quickly hurry on, I talked too much here, to the next section there on the shedding of blood. And this is another version. Would you mind reading that for us, please? Read the whole business from 1 to 7. What's your first name? I should know it.
Terry.
Terry, okay.
God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth. The fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth, and upon every bird of the air, upon everything that creeps on the ground, and all the fish of the sea. Into your hands they are delivered. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. And as I gave you the green plants, I give you everything. Only you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. For your lifeblood I will surely require a reckoning. Of every beast I will require it, and of every man. And every man's brother I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image. And you be fruitful and multiply, bring forth abundantly on the earth and multiply in it."
All right.
I don't know if it's fourth or fourth.
Yeah, it should be fourth. That's my typing. No secretary responsible for me. don't know what you have to say about this. It opens a lot of cans of worms. I don't think we'll ever get them back into the can, but that's not important. But there's a lot here. Very thick theology, as these priests are. They don't say much, but they think a lot. One thing is quite clear at the beginning, isn't it? That it's the same thing that we had at the beginning. Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And then instead of saying have dominion, it's just a little variant. Let's put it this way. Your domestication and dominion over all the things, Psalm 8 says, you know, giving you power over all the fish of the sea and all the animals and so forth. So you have here, your dominion and your power can go so far that the fear of you and the dread of you will be upon every beast. So this is not yet the end time when the lion will lie down with the lamb and nobody will fear. But this is the time, the historical times in which you and I live. And you can domesticate animals, not only follow the herds, but actually have them and then kill them. But only, and I underlined that, verse 4, there are some restrictions. Because the question always arises, if that's what man is going to do, well, what is the question? What's the danger? We do it all the time. We are eating meat and so forth, and I have no particular objection to it personally, but I think we should know what we're doing. What's the danger here if man goes on and eats meat? Before that he didn't. You remember that in chapter 1 of Genesis. But now, from this point on, there's a kind of a compromise. God says you can do it only. There's a restriction. You shall not eat flesh with its life, that's with its blood. What's the problem that they're dealing with here? Well, for the Israelites, two problems. One, that you would ever eat meat without cutting the throat and giving that blood to God. In other words, that you would ever eat without thanking the Creator. Then it's unclean. That's the other thing. That's one thing. Second thing is that what?
Respect for life.
Respect for life, that man will be the worst predator there is. You see that? Just what you said. They have no respect for all the rest of creatures and just kill them off. As I saw on one of the TV shows talking about endangered species, and then one of these guys from Arizona building all the new stuff out there said, well, we got museums full of all kinds of extinct creatures that have always been there. The answer should have been, but it wasn't given, and it didn't happen in one generation. That's what we're faced with. But here, I think that there is a real, says that they can't do that. And notice, it's your lifeblood. If any beast, any bear, does this, then I require, and I'm going to be the avenger, isn't it? Do you know what they did with an ox that gored a man in Exodus? They stoned the ox, didn't they? Yes, which is rather surprising to us because it shed man's blood. Yeah, that's in Exodus 23. And here you've got whoso sheddeth the, that's the first part of it, of every man's brother I'll require the life of man. And now he has a proverb. Again, it's poetry. You can almost see it in Hebrew. Shohet ha-dam dam ha-adam, he who sheds the blood of man, ba-ha-adam, by man shall his blood be shed. You can see it's poetry. Now notice, and this is written right for you, Mary, for God made man in his own image. What's the second possibility? That the shedding of blood goes so far that it's human blood. You see that? Not only the animal, but who sheds blood? One, yeah, or one man sheds another man's blood, you know. And if that's what we're dealing with, then, all right, what does this mean?
He's profaning the image of God.
Yes, he's robbing. I like what you're saying, profaning. It's a two-sided thing, though, Herb. On the one hand, he's robbing that person of his right to live the rest of his life. But he's also robbing God of his history with that person. That's what he's doing. So he's profaning, he's in a two-fold way. Do you see that? And that can't be. Therefore, what does society, what can society, there have been a lot of interesting conclusions drawn from this, but those are conclusions. All I would want to go and say, and that's why I'm struggling here, is what may society do? And Israel, they did it. Kill the man.
Life for life.
Sure. Yep. No doubt about that. And now, I'm not saying that all of the capital punishment, sometimes capital punishment can be for racial reasons and for injustice and everything else, and then it's by no means covered by this. The government does not have absolute authority, you see that. Society does not have absolute authority, and that's not what this is saying. It's real interesting what happened when we had that terrible murder at PLU. An old lady whom I see trudging to the grocery store, coming back near the bus station where I was, or bus stop, and she stopped me right then and there. She said, that's the problem of the liberal press at PLU. They were against capital punishment. I just didn't happen to be one, but that's precisely what she said to me. I kind of, someone said that they had found the murderers, and everybody at the bus stop was talking about that. And then she's caught on, she was just walking past, but she stopped. And she said, just that. that's the reason, because you don't have capital punishment. If you'd have capital punishment, and then she lived in that neighborhood, two doors from these guys. she said that's a real mess. It should have been cleaned out long ago. And now, since Washington has a new law, capital punishment reinstated that, this is a very complex thing. Now, I maybe shouldn't have thrown that in, but at least it's very high in my thinking of. What do you say about this? Or what is the Bible trying to say about this? Can we draw any conclusions? I've been a little careful in what I said, but maybe not too careful.
A question I would raise is that by man shall his blood be shed. Is that what we call a justice, don't you?
Or yes, it's a justice. It's a nifl.
Grammatically, you can't tell the difference between a justice and a future, and a simple future. Am I right there? Whether it's a command or a statement, is it observing something that happens, or is it putting God's imprimatur, God's approval on that?
I would almost say that it's merely a proverb. See, a proverb from human life. And undoubtedly one that was used. Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. I think it is justice, I would agree with you. And I don't think it's future that this is what will happen, you know what I mean? I think it's actually a justice, let this be done. This is what must be done.
The point I hear him asking is grammatically, the future and justice are
The same form.
The same form, so that it has the alternative grammatically of being read either way without without making distinction.
That's right, and I grant that. But my question is, my comment is that I think perhaps though that I would take it as adjusive from the context.
Okay.
Because I think what you have to, you're dealing with this problem, you see, that's raised by the shedding of human blood. And therefore it puts this, now I don't want to, I really mean that, I think that some shedding of blood by the government for the wrong reasons is absolutely not what's in here. And I don't think that this is the only way to take care of the shedding of blood. I think the rabbis had what they call noachic ordinances. That meant that even though this was not yet part of the covenant of God with Israel and part of the Mosaic constitution and bylaws, that because it was mentioned here, it was incumbent upon all Gentiles. And you might remember that when they had that compromise in Acts 15 between at the assembly in between Paul and his Gentile congregation, they said, all right, if the Gentiles want to become Christians without being circumcised, that's okay, but be sure that those Gentiles do what? Keep themselves from idolatry, from things strangled in blood. Remember that? I think that was it. And from immorality. Those were the three things that they simply mentioned in Acts 15. And that's part of an old tradition that the rabbis say even a Gentile should not eat something that's strangled in blood, this blood hadn't given to God, nor should it, a Gentile should not involve himself in immorality or in the worship of false gods. There's only one God. That he doesn't have to be circumcised. So kind of eternal, what shall we call him, not quite a proselyte, but a fearer of God, a man who's interested in Judaism. And that's how a Gentile could become. That's kind of interesting. Mary?
Ralph, in verse 4, you're saying that you shall not eat flesh of its life, that without, and this implies that without giving thanks and gratitude to God and recognizing the giver, is that what you said?
Yes.
Well, then why do you immediately switch and not make lifeblood read for your thankfulness or your gratefulness, I will surely require a reckoning?
Oh, because in their connection with what he's talking about here, that they just, to have something that was just pulsating with blood, you know what I mean, or just had not let the blood flow out. And they're very careful about that ritually. And it's still got that lifeblood in it. They take it very physically. That makes the whole meat unclean, and you that eat it. And so it's not a matter that they could get by with that by simply having a nice prayer. Get the idea? When I said that about, I was kind of New Testamentizing it for us, that all things are clean, and if, I think isn't it in the pastorals, if they are, it's in, I think, First Timothy, received with thanksgiving. So that our thing would be that the meat that we, and the food that we eat is unclean for us if we don't receive it as gifts of God. That's, I was New Testamentizing when I said that. I wasn't trying to exegete the ancient text. For the Israelites here, there was no out. You just couldn't have anything that had blood in it. You couldn't have blood sausage, you see that. I, as a Christian, that doesn't bother me. And you raised the question last time, how come these ancient things are still obligatory on modern Jews? Well, for Reformed Jews, they're not obligatory, you see that. Conservative Jew will do it, not with all the rigor of an Orthodox Jew. But the Orthodox Jew, they're winning out, especially in Israel today, and winning out throughout Judaism. They simply say, this was God's will, and you don't change God's will. And even if it may be old-fashioned and outdated, we're not going to update it. And so they'll keep the laws right down the line.
With the parallelism of the first segment of this with creation account, is there not also a sense of parallelism with the Cain-Abel account as in terms of what we're dealing with now? potentially as being parallel with the outcome, at least, of the Cain and Abel?
That's very good. In the Cain and Abel story, God could have said at the end, let society take care of it. Do you see that? All he said in his sentences to Cain, now that you've done this, the ground will not, you won't be a good farmer. It won't give you its increase. Do you see that?
Mm-hmm.
And you'll be a fugitive and a vagabond. And then it does mention this because government was no longer, not in it as much as the family to take vengeance. Anybody who sees you will take a pot shot at you because you're a murderer. Do you see that? And usually that was in the hand of the family in the administration of justice and requiring that. And the Redeemer would do that and leave from the family. Whereas here, it's just a little different.
Well, I was thinking in terms of the, even on the mark of Cain, for your lifeblood, I will surely require a reckoning.
Mm-hmm. This business of
every man, every man's brother, I will require the life of man.
Mm-hmm.
No, there seems to be some...
It is a parallel, yes.
Yeah.
Except that it isn't stated in so many words
right.
in the one, whereas
right.
it is in the other.
Well, nor is the creation stated in,
no,
in
no.
quite the same words.
No, it's dealing with the same thing. Listen, I think we'll just leave the next part, because we talked enough about the rainbow, didn't we? Our time is up.
We've got time problems.
Yes, we've got time problems here. And we did talk about it, and I think that...